Serious Money with Claire Barrett, personal finance and FT money editor at the Financial Times.
It's that time towards the end of the week when we preview the pages of the Financial Times weekly money supplement with Claire Barrett, personal finance editor of FT Weekend Money. Claire, welcome back. I'm fascinated to talk to you. I've had a glimpse of some of the things we're talking about. We're going to start by talking about a piece written by Charles D. Ellis, The End of Active Investing. This is absolutely fascinating. Please explain what this is about. I suppose we have to start by talking about the difference between active investing and index funds.
Active investing essentially means that you're paying a fund manager to pick stocks on your behalf, whereas an index fund, you're choosing to track the whole index, you know, like the FTSE 100 or the S&P 500 being two of the most widely traded indexes, whereby you'll have a little piece of every company that makes up that index, in effect. So if the market moves up, you move up, market moves down, you move down. Whereas with the fund managers, the active fund managers, what they're trying to do is generate a performance that's greater than their benchmark index, whatever that may be, by picking the shares that they think are going to outperform, the winners. There's only one problem with this approach, of course. More and more evidence is mounting up showing that active investing is not, in fact, producing those superior returns that we would like to think it would justify, because, of course, the cost of investing in active funds is much greater. Not only the cost of, you know, paying for all of those fund managers to be employed and offices for them to live in, fancy cars and golf courses perhaps for them to practice their golf shots on, but also you're paying for a higher volume of trades, you're paying for expertise, you're paying for research, you know, so there's a whole load of costs that can be both.
And as the piece points out, these costs, which may only be 1% of assets each year, but in a market where returns tend to be much lower, it's that much more severe, you know, eating into your funds.
It's much more noticeable, and certainly we have a corresponding news story, in fact, coming out with FT Money tomorrow about how UK investors are increasingly falling in love with passive funds. It's moved up the number of investors holding passive funds on the UK's biggest retail broking website, Hargreaves Lansdowne. However, it's still really quite anemic proportions. Only 1 in 10 of investors using the Hargreaves platform own a single passive fund, although that's much better than it was 5 or 10 years ago. But it still shows you it's the big names in active management who are attracting a lot of the money, and some of them do outperform. But as Charles Ellis, the US investment consultant, he's just written a book on the subject called The Index Revolution. Over the past 10 years, 83% of active funds in the US have failed to match their chosen benchmark, and 40% have done so badly that they've been terminated before the 10-year period is completed. So his data takes account of funds that have been kind of absorbed by other funds, you know, folded together or stopped, which is why we can get to this figure of 83%. And also, you might think, well, you know, they're US statistics, but because international institutions now dominate all stock markets, you can expect a similar trend to be happening at an underlying level within other markets, including the UK.
Well, it's a fascinating story. We've only really covered the surface. It looks as though the history of fund management since sort of 1960, well worth reading. Let us move on then to the second piece, which is Merrin Somerset Webb's column, which is headed "Why I'm Not That Into Warren Buffett."
I know. Oh, Merrin.
So tell us about this.
Well, we've talked a lot about value investing in recent months, and obviously Warren Buffett is perhaps most famous for being a value investor. And this is why Merrin says, you know, everyone loves him, wealth managers, fund managers, most financial journalists. In fact, many write an article about Buffett's brilliance at least every 2 years, headlined "How to Invest Like Warren Buffett," but of course she doesn't. The reason she's not that into is because she thinks, this is what she argues in her FT Money column this week, that actually he's moved away from being what she determines a proper value investor in the way that Benjamin Graham was. Today, Merrin thinks, he's far closer to being what she calls a quality growth investor, in the style perhaps of famous UK fund managers Neil Woodford and Nick Train. So nothing's wrong with that per se. We have lots of arguments about whether growth and value are really different styles of investing. But she says that they are. And if you look at the stock market and some of the big decisions that Berkshire Hathaway has been making recently, she doesn't think it's value companies that he's necessarily got in his sights.
Yes.
That you looked further afield.
it's interesting, isn't it? Because Buffett's reputation, to some extent, almost relies on the earlier days when it was easier being Warren Buffett before the world had heard of Warren Buffett.
Well, yeah, this is true, and also we've already had some comments on FT.com saying, well, now he's got billions to invest. Obviously, you would expect his style and his strategy to have changed. But Merin, of course, is a big fan of Japan. She used to work there, and she thinks that in a search for real value, Japan is a good place to look. And one of the main reasons for that is dividends. And she thinks that the dividends on offer of Japanese listed companies are not only more sustainable than those perhaps in the UK than the US, because the dividend cover on the FTSE 100 is just 1.3 times, whereas in Japan it's much, much higher. And the average yield is knocking around 2.5%, she says, higher than the US. So she points out some good points about that market in her column. But most intriguingly, she signs off with an intriguing reference to the fact that she's been recently dressing up as Wonder Woman. And if you follow me on Twitter, I'm at Claire B. I've just tweeted out a picture of Merin Somerset Webb dressed up as Wonder Woman. It's all for a very good cause, a charity for children's literacy in Leith, called Superpower Agency. So if you want to read the column and see a picture of Merin as Wonder Woman, who needs Warren Buffett?
I think anybody who reads Merin Somerset Webb each week couldn't possibly not go to Twitter and have a look at that, Claire. Let's move on to the third subject, which sounds the slightest, but actually could be incredibly valuable. Its title is The Hidden Value of a Good Night's Sleep. Now, explain this, because actually it does put almost a monetary value on sleep.
Yeah, well, you may have noticed just before Christmas there were some big kind of economic surveys that came out trying to work out what the value of insomnia or a bad night's sleep was doing to the economy. And globally, some researchers, a firm called RAND, think that this is a $680 billion problem for those developed world economies, because of the lost economic output from poor sleep. So, you know, if you have a really rubbish night's sleep and you get to work bleary-eyed, you're not working to the best of your abilities. Maybe you're absent from work. Maybe you're not able to learn properly as a teenager, slumbering at the back of the class. So they've added all of these things together. And so for the UK, they think this costs us $50 billion a year in lost productivity, which is equivalent to 1.9% of GDP. So a fairly sizable problem. If you're very rich, like the chief executive of a big company, and you're suffering from sleep deprivation, then one solution is to pay thousands of pounds to go to these little series of sleep clinics that are cropping up in Switzerland, where you can go to bed for the night. You'll have 21 different sensors attached to your body, measuring everything from adrenaline and your blood, your heartbeat and your breathing patterns. And you'll also be videoed as you sleep, and they'll then analyse the full extent of your problem and what could be causing it. So we sent the author Daniel Pembury to try one of these out, and he was absolutely staggered to find, after he thought he was asleep for 7 hours in this clinic, actually he woke up 32 times, and he could only remember a fraction of those times upon rising in the morning. So they did lots and lots of tests on him and basically said, you know, it's underlying levels of stress that are causing him to have such poor sleep.
I was really intrigued as well. This is also something quoted from the RAND report, that those getting less than 6 hours a night face a 13% higher risk of dying earlier than those sleeping for the recommended 7 to 8 hours. I mean, that is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's pretty staggering. I mean, when your body sleeps, that is when you when you recover, you know, when the body heals itself, also when the time, you know, which you need to recharge your batteries. And you know, if you're not getting that deep sleep and the rest that you need, then it can be catastrophic for your health and even put you at greater risk of you know, bad conditions developing later on in life.
Claire, thank you. Three fascinating pieces, a hint of what is going to be in the Weekend Money section of the FT tomorrow. I've been talking to Claire Barrett, Personal Finance Editor. Claire, thank you very much indeed. Looking forward to you tweeting your picture dressed as a superhero very soon, and look forward to talking to you next week. That's Claire Barrett, the Personal Finance Editor of FT Weekend Money.
Serious Money with Claire Barrett, Personal Finance and FT Money Editor at the Financial Times.